This week's sermon is from the series Trusting God in Life's Muck, a sermon series on the life of Joseph.
I don't know about you guys, but in my house, there's two kinds of apple cider. There's the good stuff and there's everything else. And the delineation is everything else is the stuff that's made from concentrate and the good stuff is freshly squeezed apple cider. I love it. My folks actually own an apple press. Now here's a picture of one. It's the same concept except for it's a wine press. But if you don't know it, usually there's this grinder that grinds everything up and you work in that and then it goes down into this bucket. And the bucket has these wood stakes around it and there's usually like a cheesecloth or some kind of a mesh thing that it allows the juice to go through it but not all the chunky stuff. And you push it down, you squeeze it, and it creates this compacted mess of just dried up stuff, but the good stuff, the sweet stuff, the chunky even stuff of apple cider comes out of it. Well, A.B. Simpson, the actual guy who started the Christian Missionary Alliance, has this quote, and he says this, "Out of the presses of pain cometh soul's best wine, and the eyes that have shed no rain can shed little shine." Now, what he means by that is often those who suffer the most, there's a depth there. And that those who have suffered, those who have gone through difficult circumstances, often have the ability to have a joy that may sometimes, and a depth to them that sometimes people don't. That's true of people in my own life. I got to admit that the people that I respect the most, those that I actually see a character in them and a love in them and a genuineness in them, many of them, when you learn their stories, they may not lead with it, but when you learn their stories, they've gone through some really, really difficult stuff. And yet their faith remains because they've seen God work. And it's not always in the miraculous, but it's in ways that they didn't expect. And it's a powerful thing. And so today, this passage really applies to our not only our text, but really the whole life of Joseph. We are continuing our sermon series on the life of Joseph, and we find ourselves in Genesis 39, verses 1 through 23. It's Joseph and Potiphar's wife. I'm sure it's a passage that's familiar to most of us. It's a text that you probably learned in Bible school or in Sunday school if you have familiar with church. And even if you haven't, it's probably something you've seen in any of the adaptations of the Joseph movie or even the musicals or those kind of things. Because it's a tragedy, really. It's a story of being pressed and yet seeing God at work. And so I encourage you to think about that quote, "Out of the presses of pain cometh the soul's best wine, and the eyes that have shed no rain can shed little shine," by A.B. Simpson, as you hear this, and maybe even apply it to our own lives. So read with me in Genesis 39, verses 1 through 23. This is the word of the Lord. "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian, who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted his care to everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, 'Come to bed with me.' But he refused. 'With me in charge,' he told me, 'your master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns has been entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?' And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by the cloak and said, 'Come to bed with me.' But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. 'Look,' she said to them, 'this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, and I screamed. But when he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. And then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me. He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. As I said, we're going to skip a chapter. There's a section in Genesis, in Genesis 36, where Judah and Tamar, but we're really focusing on the life of Joseph, so that's why we skipped ahead. But for those of you who would have been reading through the Bible, there would have been a little bit of a divergent of the story. And so the narrator, Moses, the author of the book of Genesis, makes it clear and reminds us where Joseph is. He had just been sold into slavery by his brothers, and Midianites or Ishmaelites, there's probably both in the group, had bought him and were on their way to Egypt. So when we land in verse 39, we see that Joseph is actually sold to Potiphar, and this is where he's at. He's now made it to Egypt. He's made it safely there, and he's sold into slavery. I want you to think how completely bewildered Joseph would have been. I mean, this is a young man. We're told he's about 17 years old in the Genesis 37. And here he is, the favored son who had everything he wanted at his disposal, including that beautiful robe and his father's love. And now he's treated in this low, low kind of a way. This man who was adored on by his father is now literally standing on probably a slave block, naked and being prodded and checked out by potential buyers who wanted to know what they were getting themselves into. And so we see that here he is. He was a complete foreigner in a land. All the culture, everything was different. Think about your own life, those times when maybe you've moved and you're in a new neighborhood and you don't have any friends. I remember when Steph and I moved from Wilsonville to Vancouver, we didn't know anybody. And to have to move into a new neighborhood and try and meet new people was hard, especially in the middle of the winter. But think about if you'd ever gone to a new school or started something new, that transition, how difficult it is. Well, not only is he in that, he has no idea what the culture is. He has no idea who anybody is. He can't even speak the language. And so this person who was well-favored by his father, who is spoiled, we know that, now is on the bottom end of everything and completely bewildered. Think about what it would be to go through that at such a young age, to have all your world turned upside down. This is where Joseph finds himself in the opening chapter. Betrayed, broken, defeated. And yet, we get these hints that even though life is going hard, and even though things aren't going the way that he would have expected, that maybe God's dreams that he gave him, these visions that that Joseph had, that Moses records, may actually happen. If you remember, Joseph had dreams that his brothers would bow down to him as wheat, but also the sun and the moon and the stars. And even his father understood that there was this idea that maybe he was destined to greatness. But it doesn't seem like any of that stuff's going to happen. As a matter of fact, his brothers specifically say that they're going to try and do what they can to thwart the dreams. That's why they were going to kill him, but eventually sell him. But here in the opening line, we see that Joseph is in close proximity to the ruler of Egypt. Potiphar, the most powerful man, was a powerful man because he was in charge of Pharaoh's secret service. And Joseph works underneath Potiphar, who's right next to Pharaoh. And so there's a proximity there. And we can see that maybe there's hope that Joseph's dreams and everything that God had promised would actually come to conclusion. But there's also something that we see here. And that is this, that God was Joseph's covenantal companion in the midst of the difficult circumstances. Now, why do I say covenantal companion? Well, because if you remember back in Genesis 12 and throughout the actual first half of Genesis, God made a covenant with Abraham, Joseph's great-grandfather, and Isaac, his grandfather, and Jacob, his dad, that he would be their God and that he would be with them. And one of the signs that he would be with them is that they would be in the land. That's why when Jacob actually moved to the area where they were at, where Joseph got taken, it was a sign that God was being faithful to his promises, that he would do what he said that he did. And now Joseph, who had heard those things, would have been wondering, I'm ripped away, I'm in exile in Egypt, about as far away from God as you can get and his blessings of the land. But yet Moses repeats over and over and over again in this passage. I mean, count it. It literally is almost a dozen times that God is with him. And he wants us to know that even though things don't look good, even though it looks like life has gone through a dark tragedy, that God is there with him, keeping his promise, and he is there in the midst of these difficult circumstances. God is Joseph's covenantal companion. Look at that. It says it like three or four times just in this opening section, how much the Lord was with it. And even pagans saw this, that something was different about Joseph because God was with him. This is important for us because it's important for us to think about in our own lives. But when we go through these dark times, that we have this fundamental understanding and reminder ourselves that God is with us no matter how difficult the circumstances will be. Well, because God was with him and because God was working through Joseph, we see that he actually moved up the corporate ladder. You see here that it says that Joseph started off as a simple house servant. Then he became Potiphar's attendant, and he took charge of the entire household. And finally, it says that he became responsible for everything Potiphar owned. And so we see that there's this trajectory of Joseph. He is a slave, but he's not the menial slave who does the outdoor work. He's an indoor slave because Potiphar noticed there's something different about him. And when Potiphar saw his work ethic and the way that he did things, and he saw that everything that he touched God blessed, he promoted him until he entrusted him with absolutely everything. It says that Potiphar didn't even have to worry about anything because he trusted Joseph that much. If the story would end here, we would think, wow, we can see where God's at work. I mean, sure, this tragedy of his brother selling him and him coming to Egypt is a terrible thing. And yes, he's sold into slavery, but he's a slave of the second in command. Well, not quite second command, but someone close to Pharaoh. And he's rising up the ranks. We could see where God is at work. But all of a sudden, it takes another detour, just like in Genesis 37. And we wonder, where is God in all this when Joseph is betrayed by Potiphar's wife? Joseph was a handsome young man. It says it right there in Genesis 39, verse 6. He was well-built and handsome. Now, this should be a phrase that should always kind of ring the bells that something bad could happen. I've said it before. It's too bad that the Bible doesn't have a theme song or kind of have that musical underlay, because if we had that to kind of give us the sense that something bad is going to happen, this phrase, well-built and handsome, would be it. It was a phrase that was used of his great-grandmother Sarah before Abraham tried to marry her off to the Egyptians because she was so beautiful. And it was also used of his mother when Jacob came and found her right before his future father-in-law tricked him into marrying her older sister. And so when this phrase happens, kind of that dark theme music would come, and we would be knowing that something bad is going to happen. And sure enough, we see that that is exactly what happens. Potiphar's wife repeatedly sexually harasses Joseph. She's curt. She's short. It literally is two words in Hebrew. Lie with me. But he knows what it is. And when we read this story, it's often easy for us to kind of view it as kind of, this nonchalant thing. You know, I mean, this woman who wants to have an affair with this man But really, if we want to have the proper image of the power dynamics and the things that are happening in this story, we need to view her almost as a Harvey Weinstein and see that she is a female version of him who uses her power and her might and uses whatever things she can to try and do this. If you've read the stories of Harvey Weinstein, it's terrible what he did. And he was a producer in the movies and literally did terrible things to all kinds of actresses. But here is that kind of connotation. She was the one who was in power, and she had an appetite, and she wanted it met. And she, I'm sure, is used to getting her way, that this isn't the first time this has happened. And so she commands Joseph to sleep with her. He's put in a tough spot. He's been given this privilege. This is his master's wife. He himself is a young, red-blooded man who probably had his own kind of urges and those kind of things. And so what is he to do? And she's relentless, constant. It says in here, day after day after day. But Moses says that Joseph refuses her proposition. Even though it had the potential to cost him, he refused. And at first, it was okay. He gave three reasons for why he couldn't do that. One is he said he doesn't want to break Potiphar's trust. Now, his language here could seem a little bit cocky, like, hey, there's no one more in charge than me. But really what he's saying is, look, you need to understand that your husband, Potiphar, my master, has trusted me with everything, and I feel the weight of that responsibility. He has made it in charge, so there's no. I am the ultimate person in charge, and that is a big thing to entrust with me, and I don't want to break that trust. The second thing is he reminds her that she's a married woman. I mean, he says it right there, because you are his wife. And the final reason for why he refuses is that this sinful act goes against God's will. He says, how could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? He uses logic. He uses the relationship with his wife and a theological reason for why he shouldn't do this, and communicates this to this woman to try and get her to back off and to leave him alone. But she sees something that she wants, and she will do everything she can to make it happen. And so we don't know. The details of the story aren't exactly clear. Whether she told all the servants to leave, it's clear that he tried to kind of avoid her. In the language there. And someday he comes into the house, and all of a sudden what is normally bustling and going around with all the noise of all the people there, he probably walks in and notices an eerie silence. The tigress has set the trap to try and pounce on this young victim once again. And she does that. She sets up the trap and she grabs him. She calls him to bed once again, lie with me in force, and grabs him this thing. And the language here is very violent. It's not just a grab, it's the grab and thrust and move. She literally is a tigress who pounced on her prey. Joseph is in a terrible situation. Thankfully, he's able to get out and wiggle his way out, but he leaves the cloak. Isn't it ironic that in Genesis 37, the cloak is what is used to deceive his father? And in this situation, she hangs onto the cloak in her hand, and that image of the hand in Hebrew is often an image of power. And it repeats this multiple times, more than you would think, to kind of hit this idea that she has this cloak in her hand because she has the upper hand. She has the power, and she's going to use it to her advantage, because Joseph did not go with her advances. And so she lies to the staff and to her husband and does everything she can to get sympathy. If you look at her, she is like a master manipulator. She plays things to her advantage and knows how to size up the crowd and twists things and says things in such a way to try and bring as much sympathy as she can upon herself. Right there in the very beginning, she uses the cloak as proof of her deception. If I'm Joseph, I got to think, man, these cloaks are dry. They are my downfall. But there she is holding it. And she says, she yells, she screams at the things and say, look what happened. This man tried to attack me. And when I screamed, he ran away. And here's this cloak that he left as proof. Here it is. See? When we know that Moses already told us it's the exact opposite. She pounced on him and grabbed the cloak and he fled. But she uses it as an example of, look, he was scared and he was the offender here trying to do everything. She uses it as a ploy. This is her ace in the hole, she thinks, her master evidence. Not only that, she plays the race card. You see this language here? To the servants who are in the house, who are subordinates to Joseph, even though she's the master's wife and probably didn't give them much time of the day, she probably, if she had this kind of an image of being a sexual harasser, knowing that this is it, the people were probably on edge. But to that crowd, she says, look what this man did. He tried to make sport of us, this Hebrew, a pejorative term, to try and bring the two of them together. It's a us versus Joseph kind of way because he's a Hebrew. And she uses that same kind of language when she talks to Potiphar as well. But when she's with Potiphar, this language of us, me and the staff together, disappears. And instead, it comes to, quite frankly, blame of Potiphar himself. If you look at the language, she blames her husband for bringing Joseph into the house. It's your fault this happened to me because he tried to take advantage of me. Doing everything she can to manipulate all the emotions, all the sympathy, and everything she can and hide from the truth. Think of the position that Potiphar was in. This man that he saw himself that God was behind. There's something different about him. This man that he had entrusted over a period of time, and we don't know how long of a time it went through, trusted so much that he gave him complete control of everything. And now here his wife is making a huge, huge accusation. The scripture tells us in the Hebrew, it says just that Potiphar became angry. And when we read this, it's easy for us to kind of read our own thing into it. Oftentimes when we read it, we think, oh, well, this is the righteous kind of an anger because the wife kind of tricked him into believing that Joseph went after her. And so he's angry at Joseph because he betrayed him and because of what he did try to do to his wife. And if he had believed his wife, that would be the case. It would be a righteous anger. But the Hebrew is a little bit more ambiguous than that. In fact, there's hints that Potiphar probably didn't really believe his wife. You see, Potiphar was the commander of Pharaoh's secret service. He was a war and a soldier and a policeman who knew how to size people up. If he really thought that Joseph had done this to his wife, the punishment for his crime would have been execution on the spot. But that's not what Potiphar did. No. Once again, we see that what should have happened or could have happened or was even talked about happening in Genesis 37, Joseph's death is moved. And he moves to slavery once again. You see those themes? There's the theme of the cloak and deception. And there's this idea that Joseph could be killed, but yet he's spared. And so I personally believe that Potiphar knew that his wife was lying. But he was in a tough spot. And so he put Joseph in prison. But he didn't put him in the worst of prisons. He put him in the king's prison, where all the king's prisoners were confined. And to me, it kind of hints at the fact that Potiphar probably knew that his wife was lying, that the character that he had seen, the trust that he had of Joseph was founded. But nonetheless, Joseph is put in prison. And as we end this story, it ends where it begins, with this language that Moses highlights again and again and again, that God was with Joseph in prison. Almost verbatim, the lines in Genesis 39, verse 20, and the first part of Genesis are there. That while Joseph was there, the Lord was with him, and he showed kindness and granted him favor. This time, not in the eyes of Potiphar, but in the eyes of the prison warden. And so what we see here is that Joseph is once again given responsibility because the warden saw God was with him. We see the same moving up the corporate ladder to where the warden entrusted him with everything. Everything. Everything in prison. He was under his care. So much so that he didn't even pay attention. And again, we see that God is with him. We see once again that God never left Joseph, and he remained his faithful covenant companion. Here in the midst of the story, there's darkness, dark tragedy, terrible things. But yet Moses wants to bookend it with these promises and reminders that no matter how difficult and no matter how dark it seems, that God never left Joseph. He is his faithful covenant companion. This is why Moses repeats it over and over and over again. So how does the story of Joseph relate to us? Well, there are lessons for us. I mean, usually we can, and there's one, we can see that our success is a gift from God. In America, we kind of have this idea that if you work hard and you do everything you can, that you can earn yourself and you can move yourself up. You can have the American dream. And there is some truth to that. If we work hard, there is a natural, usually kind of a blessing there, but what we're reminded in this passage is that, yes, Joseph was successful, but there's someone behind the scenes who's actually doing this success. And it reminds us that our success is a gift from God. That's why James 1, verse 16 through 18 says that every good and perfect gift is from the Lord. We can't claim that on our own too much. It's a gift. There's also, a lesson that we can see that we're called to live lives of integrity and flee from temptation. We see that Joseph has a temptation that he could easily have gone with. I mean, Potiphar's wife just threw herself on him, forced herself on him. And you can see we're natural to do that way. But what does he do? He stands up, he speaks the truth, and he flees from temptation. And we can see that 1 Corinthians calls us to do that, to flee from sexual immorality. But if this is what we think is the point of the story, we've missed it. Because usually if this is what we want to see, if these are the lessons you want to learn, things go the way that they should. You know, you do the right thing, and what you get is rewarded for that. And what we see is there is this reward that God is working in Joseph's life, but yet he does everything wrong and he has to face terrible and difficult circumstances. And so for us, this is a good reminder for us that even if we do this well, we may still face difficult circumstances. There are times when we face dark circumstances because of our own terrible decisions. We thrust ourselves into these difficult times. But what we see is that even though we try and faithfully do everything that God's commanded us to do, it doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer and that we're not going to go through difficult times in our own. And when we face those times, we need to remember this, that sometimes God calls us to difficult places. John 15 says this, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. But as it is, you do not belong to the world, but I've chosen you out of the world. And this is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also." And so remember that even though we may do things right, we may do everything we can to try and follow the Lord and obey his will, it doesn't mean that life's going to go perfectly. isn't what the health and wealth gospel preaches, is it? But we see this in Scripture over and over and over and over again, that God is faithful, even in the midst of those difficult circumstances. And so this is really this is the point of the passage. The reason why Moses bookends these difficult circumstances with this thing, reminding the people of Israel who would be reading this, that God was still with them, even in the midst of the dark times, was really so that that truth would sink in. That even though life may come at us and make us doubt whether or not God is really there, he is. And us, as New Testament believers who put our hope and trust in Jesus, we can have that same assurance that no matter how difficult life may go, and yes, people will betray us. People may say slanderous things about us, even though we did the right thing. People may not treat us the way that we do. They may come at us. Other things may come and shake in our life in difficult ways, health issues, financial issues, all these things. Those things that can make us wonder, where is God in all this? But the story of Joseph reminds us that Christ is our covenantal companion and God is always with us. That's what his name means, right? Emmanuel, God is with us. And Jesus' final words himself, he says, when he leaves his disciples, he says, I will be with you to the very end of the age. And so as we go through life, especially in those moments when we wonder, where is God in all of this? We remember that the Bible has these same bookends of God in the garden and God in spending eternity with him. And our life is in the muck in between. But just because we don't see it doesn't mean that he's not at work in it. Now, we may not always get the answer to why he's allowing this to happen. But we do know that we are never alone in our pain and our suffering. Because Christ Emmanuel, God is with us. And if he's drawn us to faith, if he's empowered our hearts to put our hope and trust in him as our Savior, he will be our constant covenantal companion. And we may go through times where we wonder, where we doubt, but we will find out that even in those times when it seems like the only thing we have is Jesus himself, that his grace is sufficient and his power is made perfect in our weakness. That yes, even in the midst of these difficult times, when it feels like the pressure is coming at us and bringing these concerns of our souls, I'm sure Joseph went through these difficult times, that God can use it to produce a deeper faith in us and a sweeter faith in us than we could ever imagine, because we're not alone. God is with us. Let's pray.
You are listening to a sermon from Crossway Church in Battleground, Washington. You can learn more about our church online at crosswaychurchwa.com. We invite you to attend a worship service on Sundays at 10 a.m. at 311 North Parkway.